Okay, welcome back, everyone. A couple announcements. Hopefully, you're well aware I'm finished with it, but the Tiny Box Challenge design comparison is due today by midnight. The PCB layout will be due in 2 weeks on November 13th. Call at that point, you'll need to have made a decision regarding the two options for final exam. So if you want to go forward with trying to prototype and test your converter design, then a complete PCB layout ready for fabrication, as well as a parts list that we can order, will all be due on November 13th. If you want to stay away from testing, want to just take a written final, then option two, you'll just have to turn in some base layout where you kind of put the blocks together so we can get an idea of what the volume would be. And then you'll be done with the Tiny Box Challenge on option two. Okay. In addition, we do have a homework next week. I'll post that sometime after class. It'll cover what we did in sinusoidal analysis. I have not finished grading the midterms yet, but I'll be working on that more after class. Hopefully get that done today. And then I will be trying to at least get a quick look at all the design comparisons over the weekend so I can give you some immediate feedback before you start doing any layout, regardless of which option you're going for. Any questions on anything there? Concerns or comments? Signs of life? Okay, well, if not, then we will dive into lecture for today. And we've wrapped up really everything I want to cover on these quasi-resonant switch implementations last class. And today we're going to kind of pivot in a new direction and cover a new topic. Before I do so, I just kind of want to take a prospectus on where we are in terms of power converter analysis. So far, assuming you've taken an undergraduate type power electronics class in this class, some of the main topologies that we've talked about are here. We've talked about the PWM small ripple in 481 or whatever your introductory power electronics course is, things that cover CCM operation of buck boosts and so on. And in this class, we supplemented that by talking about these quasi-square wave and quasi-resonant implementations, kind of those similar or same topologies, but using resonant type switching to achieve zero voltage switching or to some degree zero current switching. And then these fully resonant, dominantly AC link type topologies where the waveforms are resonant during every sub interval. We've got this AC link in the middle, some resonant tank. Those topologies are in some sense different than the PWM and even the quasi-resonant versions of the PWM in that they have these fully AC elements that are not just large ripple with some DC going through them, but that tank has fully AC waveforms. So if we try to apply regular averaging to it, it's not going to work. The average is always zero. And we've developed methods to deal with looking at, analyzing, and then eventually designing all of these types of topologies. So for our PWM small ripple, we just applied averaging. Dominantly in 481, we use waveform averaging, where we just look at the waveform of the voltage on the inductor and say its average has to be zero. Average current of the capacitor has to be zero. Look at its waveform, write those equations, and you'll get a solution to the circuit. But like we looked at previously, we can average other things. We can do switch averaging, where we average the waveforms on the switch just to get an equivalent model of the nonlinear time-varying parts of the circuit. Or we can do state space averaging, where we write the state space equations in every switching subinterval and just average them together. Averaging, the most common, widely utilized analysis technique for power electronics to deal with the time variance that they have, but has its limitations. It can't deal well with anything, any sort of dynamics that are faster than the switching frequency because they just get averaged out. So things like any of these resonant waveforms that are resonating at or above or near the switching frequency, we can't apply averaging in that case. So we talked about in this class, state plane analysis, which is really just saying, go back and directly solve the differential equations in each subinterval and link them together. State plane gives us a nice framework where we can kind of sort out the normalization the first time we use it. And then from then on, not have to actually go to the differential equations, just be able to sketch the state plane and solve it using geometry, trig, algebra. And then we briefly talked about sinusoidal analysis, not only for these AC link converters. Sinusoidal analysis, in some sense, is like an extension of averaging, where we are averaging over a certain frequency component instead of solely at DC. Okay. There's a further extension of sinusoidal analysis I mentioned last class called multi-frequency averaging, where we look at multiple different frequencies and basically do sinusoidal analysis at all those frequencies and sum them up. So that's maybe where we stand at the moment. If you have some other classes, you may have seen some other things. But I want to talk about kind of filling out this topology chart here and then filling out the analysis frameworks for them. As we go forward, this diagram that I'm going to add to is purely off the top of my head. It's not anything kind of formal or complete, but just a graphic to kind of discuss what's out there in terms of topologies. Surely it misses some things. But the next one that we're going to talk about in core in this course is switch capacitor converters. And switch capacitor converters are where we're, this kind of divergence I mentioned, they're a little bit different than everything we've talked about so far. They weren't covered in any other course, and they have some significant analysis needed that favors working up at high switching frequencies, so somewhat suitable to the overall goals of the course. But they're going to move away from this idea of looking at zero voltage switching, looking at the exact switching waveforms, because the switching that happens in a switch capacitor converter is different than everything we've looked at. All the switching we've looked at is what we call clamped inductive load, which means we've got a couple of FETs with a fixed voltage across them and some inductor holding a current through them. That's not the case in switch capacitor converters. So we'll look at them, it'll be a bit different, and we'll kind of talk about how to analyze and design these in the bulk of the remainder of lectures. Kind of filling out here, there are extensions to switch capacitor converters. We call a hybrid switch capacitor converter, which is a switch capacitor converter where we add one or more inductors that operate in relatively small ripple. And that allows us to get some advantageous characteristics. We can add some regulation ability, and we can potentially reduce some of the losses in the switch capacitor converter at the expense of having to add additional inductor, which may significantly increase the size of the converter. And then there are things like resonant switch capacitor converters, where we are, again, employing some kind of resonance during part or all of a period to improve the energy transfer and switching characteristics. Be like a switch capacitor, we add a big inductor, it becomes a hybrid. We add a small one and let it resonate, it becomes a resonant switch cap. And then we've got things like multi-level converters, which really kind of, in some sense, depending on the topology, there's no difference between a multi-level and a hybrid switch capacitor. It just depends on how you look at it and how you design it. So they're kind of fluid in this space, what we actually call these topologies. Then there's some other things that we won't touch on at all really in this course, but we can talk about modular multi-level converters being kind of series different bridges, somewhat related to AC link type converters, where we've got a couple of bridges and a tank between them. Modular multi-level converter, we'd be taking those bridges and stacking them in series in order to generate some higher voltage phase leg. Then Z-source matrix converters and anything else I'll put as a block on here, noting their existence, but not really getting into any detail on them. So our analysis frameworks, as we've discussed them so far, we've got kind of averaging down here, state plane covering these two, and then sinusoidal analysis up here. We start thinking about these different topologies. We can kind of extend averaging out for hybrid switch capacitor converters, depending on the exact energy transfer mechanisms, we may be able to just use our traditional averaging. And then for pure switch capacitors and some hybrids, if they still have some hard charging type energy transfer, we can develop this new technique, charge averaging, or called charge vector analysis sometimes, that we'll talk about in the coming lectures. But still just looks at average energy transfer between capacitors. State plane analysis will extend real well to any type of resonant circuit, whether it comes from a switch capacitor or a PWM or an AC link. So it'll cover these resonant switch capacitor implementations pretty well. We can move averaging also up into this multi-level domain. And depending on exactly how we design this multi-level converter, may be able to use state plane if it's has some significant resonance in it as well. But those multi-level converters, a little bit more complex, have some nuance to them, but largely can be modeled using the techniques we have already. So that's kind of where we'll get. Thing I want to mention, and we'll probably maybe in the last lecture of the course talk about a little bit, is discrete time modeling, which is a generalized framework which would allow us to cover any of these topologies. It's not subject to any assumptions. It is numerical by nature, essentially put everything into state plane equations and then just solve all of the differential equations for every subinterval in series. In state space type representation, that becomes simple and we can have some general results for it. But discrete time modeling is numerical by nature. Very rarely can we get any sort of analytical equation as a function of the elements of the circuit out of it. It's usually just we have a bunch of numerical matrices that we do some operations on to get our solution. This is covered extensively in a 692 that I teach. I know 692 is a special topics course number, but likely next fall I'll teach converter analysis using discrete time modeling, which is spends the whole semester talking about this framework, so we won't talk about it a lot in here. But that's kind of my general commentary on where we stand in terms of what types of converters we can look at and what modeling tools we have available to us in power electronics right now. So with that, we're going to start talking about switch capacitor converters. And we'll spend the next couple weeks developing some theory and talking about switch cap converters. And like I said, I'll mention discrete time modeling a bit at the end, mostly my little propaganda to get you to register for that 692 course next time I teach it. Okay, so diving in on switch capacitor converters, the idea with switch capacitor converters is let's build a power converter that uses capacitors only as the energy storage elements, no inductors. And then you saw from this topology listing, we'll start adding inductors back in to modify or improve in certain ways. But the initial question is, can we just only use capacitors? And why would we want to do that? Well, in terms of what's currently commercially available, the energy density of capacitors is much higher than inductors. We're looking to build something that can use very small passive elements. We want to make a high power density converter. It seems like capacitors are the way to go. Excuse me. So this is a chart from this paper referenced at the bottom, but just showing for some commercial inductors with these red X's and some commercial capacitors with these blue dots, what is the difference in energy density between the two? It shows there's a couple orders of magnitude higher energy density we can get out of a multi-layer ceramic capacitor than we can get out of a ferrite coil inductor. So given that, if we're looking to make something small, miniaturized, high power density, it seems like there's motivation to either see if we can use only capacitors or put more of the energy storage burden in the converter on capacitors and try to minimize how much energy we store in inductors. So can we build a converter out of just capacitors? If you haven't seen one before, well, the answer is yes, we can build a switch capacitor converter, and it has some limitations, but we can do energy conversion using only capacitors. And the most simple one is this 2-to-1, generally call this a ladder type switch capacitor circuit. Converter can actually be considered a bunch of different topologies. They all kind of reduce to this same thing for a 2-to-1 conversion ratio. But the idea is we've got this what we call flying capacitors, some output capacitance, and then we switch back and forth periodically with roughly 50% duty cycle between having G1 on, which would turn on this top device and the third one, and G2 on, which would turn on the second and fourth device. We've got two sub intervals, 1 and 2. They look like this. When G1 is on, kind of connect the flying capacitor in series with the output. G2 is on, we connect the flying capacitor in parallel with the output, open the input. We switch back and forth between these two things, and we can analyze this very simply under some assumptions here. So I'll assume that this output capacitance is really big, such that V approximately constant all the time. And the flying capacitor, I won't necessarily make that same assumption. I'll assume the output we can apply small ripple to. Okay. And then second, I'll assume that in either of these equivalent subcircuits, I sit in that subcircuit long enough for everything to kind of balance out. Okay, so there's going to be some charging and discharging of C fly, and I'll assume that I'm in subinterval 1 long enough for C fly to reach some steady state value, some constant value. If it's got some exponential charging or discharging, that all kind of dies out and it ends up at its final value. Okay, so V fly. Let's say in 1 and 2, V fly reaches a final value before the next switching action. It's meaning that any sort of dynamics in the change of this voltage have completed and died out before the next time, before I go into 2 or before I go back to 1. Okay. So if I've done that, then I can kind of write a couple of equations and say, okay, for each subinterval, start with 2 because it's easy. In subinterval 2, V fly goes to the output voltage by the second assumption. By the first assumption, the output voltage is constant. By the second one, by the end of the period, V fly is equal to V. And then in the first subinterval, I connect C fly in series in between the input and output voltage. So I can say again, by this assumption that everything reaches steady state and the output voltage is constant, V fly goes to VG minus V. By the end of the period. Okay. And we'll look at the actual analysis of what happens when V fly's voltage is changing. But for the moment, kind of look at these two and say, if V fly is equal to V at the end of subinterval 2 and it's equal to VG minus V at the end of subinterval 1, if I've got a big V fly and I can kind of neglect any change in voltage, it's more or less constant. The delta V fly is nearly 0. Then I can set these two equal to one another. Say V is equal to VG minus V. is VC Flies Value in 1 and 2. And then just rearrange 2V is equal to VG, or V over VG is equal to 1/2 is equal to M. And that'll just be our first cut idealized assumption on the conversion ratio of this converter. What it tells me is that this is indeed a 2-to-1 converter. I can get some voltage conversion ratio out of a purely capacitive circuit. But notably, there is no other variable here, right? Based on these assumptions, there's no duty cycle, there is no switching frequency, there's nothing. The conversion ratio is 1/2, and I can't control it. I can't change it from 1/2. This topology is just a 2-to-1 converter, okay? So that's the first drawback of pure switch capacitor converters, is that they cannot be controlled. They have, based on the topology, a fixed conversion ratio, and that's the only conversion ratio you can do. The input goes up, the output goes up along with it. The load changes and that causes some change in output voltage, there's no response you can have to that. There's no regulation at all, okay? So some of the behaviors of these switch capacitor converters, so they have a fixed conversion ratio. There is no regulation, and here I say except linear type regulation. So when we go through, because of losses in the circuit, the output voltage can drop if there is power loss. So I can get the output voltage to go even lower than 2-to-1, but all that difference is going to energy loss. So if I made a 2-to-1 converter going from 10 to 5 volts, I could get the output to go to 2.5 volts, but I'd be losing 50% of the power, have an efficiency of 50%. So as I drop that conversion ratio, all that difference in voltage is just contributed by losses, dropping it all on effective resistors. So not a regulation that we want to use, except in very small doses. Something here, i.e. lossy regulation. They are mentally not lossless, even with ideal elements. The main energy loss mechanism is kind of similar to COSS type losses. It's hard charging a capacitor through a resistance. And as we saw in the very first homework of the course, even if we set that resistance to 0, there's loss associated with that. So even if I have ideal capacitors and ideal switches, there's still going to be loss associated with charging and discharging the capacitor through a switch network. So bad things about it in these first two bullets. Good thing, okay, they can be very small in discrete implementations. They can be high power density, and they're also more suited initially to full integration, monolithic integration, an entire converter in silicon or upcoming in GaN as we continue to progress there. That's generally because we can have pretty good capacitors on silicon at a millimeter type scale or smaller. Inductors are pretty poor at that scale. Inductors, there's a lot of people researching on-chip inductors, doing good work, but they're still not great. Whereas some of these deep trench parallel caps that we can put in monolithic silicon are pretty good capacitors. And then we go up to discretes. We have, for a lot of applications, small, high density, and relatively low loss discrete capacitors available to us. Inductors, not so much, unless we hugely oversize them. Discrete caps can be small and efficient in many applications. And as with kind of everything I've said in the course, it's subject to what is your application, where does it exist in the realm of power electronics applications. If we're talking about a 10 kilovolt converter, then capacitors become a huge problem, because just getting the voltage isolation causes them to be huge. If we're talking about things in the general power supplies realm, most often caps are not the limiting factor in traditional topologies. And then integrated on chip caps, much better than on chip inductors. And then kind of all of these first three bullets, some of the benefits and drawbacks of switch capacitor converters, we can kind of completely shift or change those by going to these resonant and hybrid implementations. So a simple approach to a resonant version would retain a fixed conversion ratio and no regulation, but reduce losses associated with charging and discharging the capacitor. Hybrid versions put an inductor in there that allow us to do some duty cycle type control of the output voltage so we can get regulation back, but may still have some hard charging loss, depends on the exact implementation. Both of these then we're adding inductance to the circuit. So we're losing some of the advantage in terms of having only capacitors, only these small high density energy storage elements. Now we're back to being dependent on inductors, but potentially can use less energy storage in the inductance than if we do just a traditional PWM topology. We can just add in a very small inductor, maybe an air core, low loss thing. So to begin getting a more detailed model than what we have here of how switch capacitor converters behave, I'm going to start with just some generic analysis of charging and discharging capacitors through a few different mechanisms. So first, I'm just going to talk about, okay, kind of what happens when we use a voltage source to charge a capacitor, and we'll talk about using a current source, then we'll talk about using some resonant circuit to charge one. Go through those one by one, just look at the energy we transfer to a capacitor, how much energy is lost in the process, and what's the prospectus for high efficiency power converters based on these different energy transfer mechanisms. Okay, so starting with the voltage source charging a capacitor, I'm going to look at this simple circuit here. Voltage source, a switch I throw at time t is equal to zero to short it, some resistance in series, and my capacitor C. Okay. And I'm going to assume VC of T is less than zero before the switch is thrown. It has a voltage V1. And then after some significant amount of time, it's going to go to this voltage V2 that is the source voltage. And just for plotting, I'll say V2 is greater than V1, or charging it up to a slightly higher voltage. Okay. So let's think about the waveforms in this process. So from time t is equal to zero, I've got my voltage starting somewhere here, V1, being charged by a voltage source V2. After I throw this switch, some resistance in the circuit, it's going to have this kind of exponential climb up and then eventually steady out at V2. This is VC of T. And in order to do that, we'll have some current, call it I of t in the capacitor, but this whole circuit's a single loop, so it's the current in everything. That current at will be zero before the switch closes, and then it'll jump up to some peak of V2 minus V1 over R, and then decay down with the same exponential time constant. My I of t. Okay, and what we're going to look at initially is, let's look at the behavior assuming whatever converter we're modeling this mechanism charging the capacitor from. We allow it to sit in this circuit for some time, T sub C, which is much greater than the time constant of the circuit. So this is really our implementation of the assumption I made up here. So in any of these equivalent subcircuits, VFly reaches its final value before the next switching action. Hey, with these exponential waveforms, technically that's at time is equal to infinity before VC reaches V2. But after 3 or 4 or 5 time constants, we're close enough. We're within 1%. We could say it's approximately reached its final value. So we'll say we're going to look at this thing over some time TC, which is long enough that both of these waveforms have essentially reached their final value. So with that, and if we can approximate that each of these waveforms has reached their final value, what I want to look at in this circuit is the energy delivered to the cap, the energy supplied from the source, and the energy lost, the difference between them. Okay. So during this time, during this TC interval, we get a change in energy on the capacitor by bringing its voltage from V1 to V2. The additional energy supplied to it is just the difference between the energy at each point. So at the end here, we'll have 1/2 C V2 squared. The assumption that this is long enough, we can assume the value of VC is close to V2, minus however much energy it had when we started, 1/2 C V1 squared. And so rewrite this, 1/2 C, pull that out front, V2 squared minus V1 squared. That's how much energy we delivered to the cap, the difference between these two voltages squared individually. Then we'll look at how much energy was supplied by the voltage source, delta EV. Just going to look at during this same time, how much energy came out of this V2 source. So to find that, we'd say it's the integral from 0 to TC of V2 times I dt. And based on our assumption that we're much longer than the time constant, that's kind of enough. We could say this is approximately equal to the integral from 0 to infinity of V2 times I of t. And that'll be, okay, V2 stays constant, so we can pull it out front. And then we've got the integral of I of t, and do our typical trick here, the integral of the current that goes through a capacitor is equal to the total charge supplied to the capacitor, which then will look like C times V2 minus V1. Total current that goes to the capacitor, total charge put into it, is the charge that results in that capacitor changing its voltage from V2 to V1. Set that backwards, from V1 to V2. So change in energy from the voltage source is, we write this, CV2 times V2 minus V1. Okay. And then I want to look at, okay, what was the energy lost in this process? Energy lost is just how much energy was supplied by the source minus how much energy is still stored in the circuit at the end of this time interval. The difference between it will be how much energy didn't make it into the cap is no longer stored in the circuit. And that looks like delta EV is C V2 times V2 minus V1. Minus delta C, 1/2 C V2 squared minus V1 squared. Okay. So can I do with that? Let's expand out this first term, just expand out everything here. So we've got C V2 squared minus C V2 V1 minus 1/2 C V2 squared plus 1/2 C V1 squared. And then what we can do is combine these two terms. We've got minus 1/2 C V2 squared plus C V2 squared. Just give me a 1/2 C V2 squared plus my 1/2 C V1 squared. And then minus C V2 V1. And this is my E loss. So I'm gonna go ahead and pull out a 1/2 C. With this V2 squared plus V1 squared minus 2V2 V1. And then this expression in brackets here, note V2 squared, V1 squared, and then two times the product of the two looks like V2 minus V1 quantity squared. Okay. So I deliver energy to the cap that is V2 squared minus V1 squared times 1/2 C. I lose energy as 1/2 C times the difference between them squared. Okay. The difference between them versus the individual quantity squared, this thing will get small as V1 and V2 are large and the difference between them is small faster than this one will. Think about it. If V2 was 10 volts, V1 is 9 volts, then V2 squared minus V1 squared is 100 minus 81 is 19. V2 minus V1 is just 1 volt squared. So I'd have kind of 19 times 1/2 C for the energy transferred to the cap, 1 times 1/2 C for the energy lost. So as these voltages get large, the difference between these two expressions gets bigger. And we have the possibility of delivering a significant amount of energy with relatively low loss. Okay. What we need for that to happen is relatively large voltages and a small difference between them. Okay. If there's zero difference between them, we don't actually transfer any energy. Right? If V2 and V1 are the same thing, then we didn't transfer any energy to the capacitor and there's zero power going through this thing. So there has to be some difference between them for there to be any energy transfer. But we want it to be relatively small compared to the DC values. You can take that a step further. I'm gonna write one thing here, 1/2 C V2 minus V1, let's call that delta VC, or the change in the capacitor voltage during this interval. And I'm going to use that substitution on the next slide to look at the efficiency here. And we'll see the same kind of conclusions. So the efficiency, and though we're not really in a power converter yet, we're just looking at energy transfer between a voltage source and a capacitor with the link back to what we're doing here. Under these assumptions, this is going to look like charging a capacitor from a voltage source and then discharging it to a voltage source. Be able to apply this analysis to both of these two subintervals. And so I'm going to define an efficiency for this converter, thinking about how I'm going to use it in a switch capacitor converter later. But for this circuit, I'll just define it as the energy that went to the cap divided by the total energy that came from the source. So right, what those things are, energy that went to the cap is 1/2 C V2 squared minus V1 squared. The energy that went to the voltage source was C V2 times V2 minus V1. Right. Okay. And then I'm going to rewrite these using this delta VC term, and I'll keep V2 the voltage source, but I'm going to write V1 as V2 minus delta VC. Okay. So let's first just cancel out these C's so I don't have to carry them around. Put 1/2 out front. Top, I'll have V2 squared minus V1 is V2 minus delta VC squared. We're at the bottom, V2, V2 minus V1 is is V2 minus delta VC again. Okay. And then let's just multiply out the numerator and denominator. Keep this 1/2 out front. The numerator will have V2 squared minus, from foiling this thing out here, I get a V2 squared. I get a minus delta VC squared. And then I get minus 2 delta VC V2 times this minus sign is plus 2 V2 delta VC. In the denominator, just multiply this V2 through to everything. I get V2 squared minus V2 squared plus 2 V2 delta VC. Okay, so both on top and bottom, these things cancel out. Then I end up with 1/2 times, let's say 2 V2 delta VC minus delta VC squared over 2 V2 delta VC. And then just splitting apart this numerator and dividing through, end up with times 1 minus delta VC. One of these will cancel. We'll have delta VC over 2 V2. I've got a spurious 1/2 somewhere. Should have lost that 1/2 along the way. There never should have been a 2 here. V2, as I multiply through, that's my mistake. There's no 2 there. So this should be 1/2 times. Sorry for that mistake. Correct that. Two here where I foiled out this term squared, but there's no two in the denominator. I just multiply V2 times delta VC. Okay. So then eventually final result, multiply this 1/2 through, 2 times 1/2 is 1 minus delta VC over V2 times 2. Okay. Well, that tell me, again, kind of the same thing. As delta VC gets really small relative to V2, the efficiency will go to 1. If I have a large change in voltage relative to the DC voltage, my efficiency is going to drop significantly. Another thing to note, you've seen this already in COSS type analysis, but where did the resistance come into play in all of this? And the answer is nowhere in this derivation did it matter what this resistance is. Whether this resistance is large, small, zero, all of this analysis is the same. As long as this holds true. Here's the only spot where the resistor came into play, is when we made this assumption that the time is much longer than the time constant, such that this charging completes within the period. Well, if I've got a really large resistance, that's going to be a really long time. If I've got a really small resistance, it can be a short time. So it will affect what our timing assumption really means in terms of circuit design. But as long as we operate such that this holds, this analysis isn't affected by the value of the resistance. Sufficiency is less than one, even if the resistance goes to zero, it's still this expression. It's all built into our assumption, but doesn't show up in the analysis. Okay, so we could kind of apply this analysis back to our 2-to-1 switch cap converter. Would be is okay, in interval one, we're charging through a voltage source of VG minus V, just charging this cap. In interval two, we're discharging it from wherever it reached back down to V. And see that okay, V fly is not actually constant. It gets charged up a little bit in this interval, discharged a little bit in this interval, and that results in some small delta VC. And our efficiency is going to depend on how small we can keep that delta VC. Okay. We can get it down by using big caps. We can get it down by switching really quickly so that we don't have a lot of discharge when it's connected to the output. But both of those are a little bit mitigated by this timing constraint. If we use really large capacitors, then our RC time constant increases and we'll have to switch slower. If we try to switch slower, we'll eventually run into this RC time constant. This we'll talk about more later, but is what's called the slow switching limit. Or SSL for switch capacitor converters. Assuming that we are switching slowly enough such that all of this exponential stuff just dies out before we switch again. We'll operate differently in the fast switching limit if we start switching faster and violate this assumption, and we'll talk about how to do that next. The time, I think we'll only be able to really set up what we're talking about on this next one. We'll solve it next class. But the next one I want to look at is just what happens if we charge from a current source instead of a voltage source. So let's say I've got this current source. I'm going to set this up in a way that's maybe not really allowed. Let's say I've got a series switch in series with this current source, and the current source just pulses on from t is equal to zero until some time tc. Gives a pulse of current I that over a duration that's long enough to get the capacitor from V1 to V2 so that we can compare to the previous case. So the same circuit, resistor and our capacitor. Capacitor voltage VC. VC of T is less than zero is equal to V1. And we'll assume the capacitor voltage and goes from V1 to V2 over some time T sub C. And what we'll do is we'll give whatever current and time are necessary to get us between them. Okay. So our VC of T will, during the time the switch is closed and the current source is on, ramp up according to I over C slope. So the current charges the capacitor and it'll go from V1 to V2. So setting up this circuit so that we get the same equivalent change in energy on the capacitor over the same time as the previous circuit. Okay. The current then looks like this in this circuit. Here's my I of T. Is the current in this loop, I of T. Okay. So we'll go through the analysis at the beginning of next class, but just looking at this, we can see there might be some advantages here. So we're going to get the same change in voltage on the capacitor. So we're supplying the same amount of charge to the capacitor as we were in the previous case. but we're doing so with just a constant current over this interval. So rather than having this really large exponential spike and then decaying down, we're just giving a constant current over the entire interval to do that same change in voltage. And that should result in lower RMS currents, potentially lower loss from distributing that in a more constant rate manner, rather than the capacitor case where we have this big spike, a lot of energy delivered at the beginning, and then slowly die out. Okay. So we'll go through and analyze that and see that indeed, and over some trivial assumptions, this is a more efficient way to charge this capacitor. And eventually, this is going to be kind of a model we can use for things like hybrid switch capacitor converters, where we have an inductor in the circuit that'll hold a constant current charging and discharging those capacitors. Okay. We'll pick up there next time. We're out of time, so I'm going to stop the recording. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you Monday.